from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Booz Allen Hamilton is one of the largest intelligence contractors in America. It also plays a very strategic role, I would say, in U.S. intelligence as an advisor to agencies such as the National Security Agency.
As Booz Allen Hamilton employee Edward Snowden admits to leaking a trove of documents about the government's top secret surveillance program, we'll speak with journalist Tim Shorak about spies for hire, the secret world of intelligence outsourcing. What one former NSA director has described as a digital Blackwater. Then protests at Walmart.
They just take care of their profit, not these human faces who are making clothes for them and dying every day in the factories.
As Walmart rejects new safety standards proposed in the aftermath of the Dhaka building collapse that killed over 1,100 workers, we'll speak with former Bangladeshi garment worker Kalpana Akhtar. Last week, she protested outside Walmart shareholders' meeting. Today, she's in New York. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Obama administration's reportedly preparing to charge NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden with leaking classified information. The FBI has begun questioning relatives and associates of Snowden, a former CIA employee who revealed he's behind a massive leak of documents outlining the National Security Agency's surveillance practices. The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald has already published some of those documents and says there are more to come. Snowden's whereabouts are unknown after he checked out of his Hong Kong hotel room Monday. Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney defended the administration's policies on surveillance.
We need to strike the appropriate balance between our national security interests and our interests in privacy. The fact that upon coming into office, he assessed and his team assessed programs that existed and, in some cases, enhanced oversight. And he believes that with the oversight that exists, and the implementation of the programs as they are implemented, that the balance is appropriately struck, has been appropriately struck, but it is an absolutely appropriate topic for debate.
A support movement for Edward Snowden is already taking off in the United States. New York activist Andrew Stepanian was among dozens who rallied in Manhattan Monday.
I think a lot of us are encouraging people today, wherever they are located in the United States, whatever city they're in, to start their own rallies. United behind a hashtag that says, I stand with Edward Snowden. And no matter how small or how large, encourage the people around you to celebrate Edward Snowden and what he did selflessly for us as Americans, and to take the conversation out of the margins to prevent him from being demonized or maligned, whether it be in the media or in government, and have a conversation that said what he did was a public service.
A petition on the White House website to pardon Edward Snowden has so far received more than 43,000 signatures. A U.S. appeals court has dismissed a lawsuit against President Obama and the head of the National Security Agency over warrantless domestic surveillance of telephone calls and emails. The suit was initially filed in 2006 against the Bush administration, but in a statement on Monday, the Center for Constitutional Rights noted, quote, ironically, the dismissal comes just as a series of news stories about astonishingly broad domestic NSA surveillance have broken in the news. Meanwhile, the ACLU and other groups have filed a motion with the top-secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, asking it to make public its opinions on the section of the Patriot Act that authorizes the government to obtain, quote, any tangible thing, unquote, related to foreign intelligence or terrorism investigation. That section was the foundation for the court order exposed by The Guardian last week, demanding Verizon hand over records on millions of customers. Turkish police and riot gear have descended on a protest encampment in Istanbul's Taksim Square, firing tear gas and rubber bullets and forcing many to flee into nearby Gezi Park. Today marks the 12th day of a rising protest movement against Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan, who stands accused of imposing religious and authoritarian rule by the protesters. Today's raid came a day after Erdogan's deputy said the prime minister will meet with protesters.
Sayın Başbakanımız.
The Prime Minister gave an appointment to representatives of some of the groups that have been organizing these protests. He will meet some of them on Wednesday upon their requests, and he will meet other groups in the coming days.
Iraq appears to be falling deeper into sectarian conflict as a wave of bombings and shootings killed more than 70 people Monday. Nearly 2,000 people have died since April amidst rising tensions between Iraq's Shiite-led government and Sunni militants. Officials in Pakistan say at least 6 people are dead following an attack on a NATO supply convoy that was headed to Afghanistan. Vehicles carrying military equipment reportedly caught fire after coming under attack by unknown militants in Pakistan's Khyber tribal region. Bloomberg News reports the Pentagon seeking to spend nearly $23 billion on cybersecurity over the next 5 years, including $4.65 billion in the upcoming fiscal year, an increase of 18% over the current year. The budget outline includes more than $9 billion for defense against cyber attacks and nearly the same amount for cyber operations, which include offensive capabilities. The increased spending could be a major boon for private military contractors. The news comes on the heels of Obama's two-day meeting with President Xi Jinping of China, during which the two discussed allegations of cyber attacks on both sides. It also follows a Guardian expose on how President Obama ordered senior officials to draw up a list of potential overseas targets for U.S. cyber attacks. The Associated Press is reporting President Obama's leaning closer toward arming some Syrian rebels and could make a decision in the coming days. The report cites unnamed officials who said Obama is considering various options during White House meetings this week. Another, less likely scenario would see the U.S. enforce a no-fly zone over Syria. The Obama administration is dropping its opposition to the unrestricted sale of emergency contraception, allowing one type of morning-after pill, Plan B, one step, to be sold on store shelves, just like any other over-the-counter medication. Reproductive justice advocates hail the move as a landmark victory that caps a more than decade-long battle for access. Amidst a series of legal defeats for the Obama administration over the restrictions, a federal judge accused it of being unreasonable and blocking access for political reasons. Drug regulators actually approved over-the-counter sales of emergency contraception back in 2011, but Obama's Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius overruled that decision in an unprecedented move, forcing those under 17 to obtain a prescription. Despite reversing its stance on Plan B one step, the administration says it will continue to oppose unrestricted sales of the two-pill version, in part, it says, because it's concerned adolescents might not understand how to take the two pills. The U.S. Senate has passed a version of the farm bill that includes cuts to the food stamp program and an expansion of crop insurance viewed as a boon for big agribusiness. The bill passed with an amendment by Republican Senator David Vitter to ban people convicted of a violent crime from ever obtaining food stamps. Overall, it cuts the program by about $400 million a year. A version of the bill approved by a House committee last month would cut food stamps by about 5 times that amount. A U.S. appeals court has rejected a bid by organic farmers to prevent the agribusiness giant Monsanto from suing them over its patented seeds. The court ruled Monday the lawsuit was unnecessary because Monsanto has already promised that it will not take legal action if a farmer's crops are inadvertently contaminated with its genetically modified seeds. Monsanto has pursued more than 800 patent cases against farmers for allegedly using its seeds without paying. A lawyer with one of the plaintiff groups told Reuters, quote, "It's a very bizarre ruling that relies on a paragraph on Monsanto's website. It's a very real threat to American farmers," he said. The U.S. Supreme Court's rejected an appeal by two U.S. citizens seeking to sue former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld after they were allegedly tortured at a U.S. military prison in Iraq. Donald Vance and Nathan Ertel were detained in 2006 after collaborating with an FBI investigation into gun running by their employer, the Iraqi-owned firm Shield Group Security. They said they were subjected to extreme sleep deprivation, cold temperatures, and prolonged interrogation before being released without ever being charged with a crime. Vance and Ertel said Rumsfeld was responsible for their mistreatment because he personally approved torture techniques used by U.S. forces in Iraq. But Monday's decision maintains a lower court ruling that Rumsfeld is not liable. In North Carolina, so-called Moral Monday protests against right-wing extremism in the state legislature continued at the state's General Assembly. Nearly 100 people were arrested, including Charlotte Observer faith reporter Tim Funk, who was there covering the action with a press ID around his neck. Thousands have turned out to protest cuts to social programs and attempts to scale back voting rights. Monday marked 50 years since President John F. Kennedy signed the landmark Equal Pay Act to prevent wage discrimination against women. In a speech commemorating the law, President Obama acknowledged the gender wage gap still endures half a decade later.
The day that the bill was signed into law, women earned 59 cents for every dollar a man earned on average. Today, it's about 77 cents. So it was 59, now it's 77 cents. It's even less, by the way, if you're an African-American or a Latina. Over the course of her career, a working woman with a college degree will earn, on average, hundreds of thousands of dollars less than a man who does the same work. Now, that's wrong.
In his remarks Monday, Obama also made a brief reference to LGBT rights in the workplace, saying his agenda included building an economy that, quote, gives every American the chance to get ahead no matter who you love. But some noted Obama has so far refused to heed calls to sign an executive order banning federal contractors from discriminating against workers on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Last week, First Lady Michelle Obama was confronted over her husband's failure to take such action by a protester who interrupted her speech at a private fundraiser in Washington.
And I don't care what you believe in. We don't. One of the things that I don't do well is this.
I can take the mic,
but I'm leaving. So you all decide.
No, I'm sure.
No.
I need your husband.
After First Lady Michelle Obama threatened to leave, the protester Ellen Sturtz was the person that you heard. She's been criticized for perceived racial overtones in her action, particularly after saying she was, quote, taken aback when Michelle Obama came right down in my face, she said, in response to the interruption, a comment seen by many as evoking racist stereotypes about black women. Anthea Butler, a professor of religious studies at the University of Pennsylvania, said, quote, media coverage also played along, portraying the First Lady as the aggressor rather than Sturtz. Such a characterization read instantly to many as an exhibition of white privilege. Similar statements of any black person stepping out of their place in the 19th and 20th centuries resulted in beatings and lynchings, she wrote. Former South African president and anti-apartheid leader Nelson Mandela is remaining in the hospital for a fourth day with a recurring lung infection. A spokesperson for President Jacob Zuma said Monday Mandela remains in serious but stable condition.
Former President Nelson Mandela remains in hospital, and his condition is unchanged. He was admitted to hospital in the early hours of Saturday morning, the 8th of June, with a lung infection. And President Zuma would like to reiterate his call to South Africa to pray for Madiba and his family in these difficult times that they are going through.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Aaron Maté. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. The U.S. government has begun the process of charging Edward Snowden with disclosing classified information after he leaked a trove of secret documents outlining the NSA surveillance programs. The FBI has already questioned Snowden's relatives and associates. Snowden is a 29-year-old computer technician who formerly worked for the CIA. He reportedly turned over thousands of documents to Glenn Greenwald of the Guardian newspaper, as well as to the Washington Post. Only a few have been published so far. His current whereabouts are unknown. Snowden flew from Hawaii to Hong Kong on May 20th. On Monday, he reportedly checked out of his Hong Kong hotel, one day after The Guardian posted a video of him explaining his decision to leak the information.
Response to Edward Snowden's actions has been mixed. On Capitol Hill, Senator Dianne Feinstein accused Snowden of committing treason. Meanwhile, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg called Snowden a hero, writing, quote, "In my estimation, there's not been in American history a more important leak than Edward Snowden's release of NSA material, and that definitely includes the Pentagon Papers 40 years ago," he said. The founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, has also praised Edward Snowden.
Edward Snowden is a hero who has informed the public about one of the most serious events of the decade, which is the creeping formulation of a mass surveillance state that has now co-opted the courts, corrupted the courts in the United States, made them secret, made them produce orders which violate U.S. constitutional protections to nearly the entire population. And then if that wasn't enough, has embroiled the U.S. High-tech companies like Google, Yahoo, Skype, Facebook, etc., to extend that surveillance all across the world. The amount of collections from the United States alone revealed to be more than $2.4 billion in the month of March alone. And that is something that I and John Perry Barlow and many other journalists and civil libertarians have been campaigning on for a long time. So it's very pleasing to see such clear and concrete proof presented to the public.
Julian Assange speaking on Sky News. Up until a few weeks ago, Edward Snowden worked as a systems administrator inside the NSA's office in Hawaii. His employer was not the U.S. government, but a military contractor called Booz Allen Hamilton. Over the past decade, the U.S. intelligence community has relied increasingly on the technical expertise of private firms such as Booz Allen, SAIC, the Boeing industry Naris, and Northrop Grumman. Former NSA Director Michael V. Hayden has described these firms as a, quote, digital Blackwater. According to the journalist Tim Shorrock, about 70% of the national intelligence budget is spent on the private sector.
The leaks by Edward Snowden have also raised questions over who has access to the nation's biggest secrets. According to the Washington Post, authorities are unsure how a contract employee at a distant NSA satellite office was able to obtain a highly classified copy of an order from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. During his interview with The Guardian, Edward Snowden claimed he had the power to spy on anyone, including the president.
Analysts at any time can target anyone, any selector, anywhere. Where those communications will be picked up depends on the range of the sensor networks and the authorities that that analyst is empowered with. Not all analysts have the ability to target everything. But I, sitting at my desk, certainly had the authorities to wiretap anyone, from you or your accountant to a federal judge to even the president, if I had a personal email.
To talk more about Edward Snowden and the privatized world of intelligence, we're joined by Tim Shorrock, author of the book Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. He's just written a piece for Salon.com entitled Meet the Contractors Analyzing Your Private Data. Private companies are getting rich probing your personal information for the government. Call it digital Blackwater. In fact, Tim Shorrock, explain who exactly called it digital Blackwater.
Well, this was said by Michael V. Hayden, who used to be the director of the NSA and was the director of the NSA when President Bush began the warrantless surveillance program back in 2001, right after 9/11. He's moved on from intelligence, the intelligence agencies, to become an executive with Chertoff Group, which is a large consulting company in Washington that works very closely with intelligence agencies and corporations, advising them on cybersecurity and advising them on just basically security issues. And so, you know, he's cashed himself in and is making lots of money himself in this industry.
Let's go to the former NSA and CIA Director General Michael Hayden, who, as you said, oversaw much of the privatization of the NSA from 1999 to 2005. This is him speaking in 2011.
We may come to a point where defense is more actively and aggressively defined, even for the private sector. And what is permitted there is something we would never let the private sector do in physical space. I mean, you look, well, I mean, let me really throw out a bumper sticker for you here. How about a digital Blackwater? Okay? I mean, we have privatized certain defense activities, even in physical space. And now you've got a new domain in which we don't have any past trampled down in the forest in terms of what it is we expect the government or will allow the government to do. And in the past, in our history, when that has happened, private sector expands to fill the empty space. I'm not quite an advocate for that, but these are the kinds of things that are going to be put into play here very, very quickly.
That was the former head of the CIA and the NSA, General Michael Hayden. Tim Shorrock, talk about Booz Allen Hamilton and Edward Snowden and what this relationship is all about between Booz Allen and the NSA.
Well, the most astonishing thing I found in the articles in The Guardian and the revelation that he was from Booz Allen was that, in fact, Booz Allen Hamilton is involved at basically the darkest levels, the deepest levels of U.S. intelligence. If Mr. Snowden had access to these kinds of documents, such as these PRISM documents about surveillance on the internet, as well as this FISA court order, that means practically anyone in Booz Allen who's in intelligence working for the NSA has access to the same kinds of documents. And American people should really know that now we have conclusive proof that these private sector corporations are operating at the highest levels of intelligence and the military. And I think that's the bottom line here. It's not curious, you know, the question is not why this low-level person at Booz Allen, you know, got these documents. The question is, why is Booz Allen involved at this level of intelligence?
Tim Shorrock, so according to the New York Times, it's gone so far that even the process of granting security clearances is often handled by contractors. So can you talk about the duties that contractors are performing for the government on these intelligence matters?
Well, first of all, I want to comment on some of these stories in the New York Times and other newspapers. I mean, that's an old story. Everyone knows that, you know, the security clearances is done by contractors. That's been true for a decade or more. And, you know, Booz Allen's been around for, you know, years and years and years. The question is, why haven't these newspapers covered this? They cover intelligence as if there's no private sector involvement at all. And suddenly, they hear that Booz Allen's involved, and suddenly we have all these stream of articles about privatized intelligence. Well, welcome to the world of digital Blackwater, as Hayden calls it. And you know, specifically on Booz Allen and what these companies do, I mean, you know, they, as I wrote in my book, Spies for Hire, they do everything, you know, from, you know, CIA intervention in other countries, JSOC, you know, when it does raids, you know, contractors are involved in finding out where the people they attack are and determining, you know, the mapping and all that, and the imagery to make sure that pilots and drones can hit the right people or the wrong people. And they're involved in the, you know, Defense Intelligence Agency. They're involved in all military agencies that do intelligence. They do everything. They do everything that the government does.
What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is that it's a for-profit operation. Many times you have inside these agencies, you have contractors overseeing other contractors, contractors, you know, giving advice to the agency about, you know, how to set its policies, what kind of technology to buy. And, of course, they have relationships with all the companies that they work with or that they suggest to the leaders of U.S. intelligence. And I think, you know, a terrible example of this is, you know, a few months ago, I wrote a cover story for The Nation magazine about the NSA whistleblowers that you've had on this show a few times, Tom Drake, Bill Benny, and the other two. And, you know, they blew the whistle on a huge project called Trailblazer that was contracted out to SAIC that was a complete failure. And this project was designed from the beginning by Booz Allen, Northrop Grumman, and a couple of other corporations who advised the NSA about how to acquire this project and then decided amongst themselves to give it to SAIC. And then SAIC promised the skies and never produced anything, and the project was finally canceled in 2005. And it's very ironic that Michael Hayden says he's not sure about, you know, this privatization. I mean, he's the one who set this whole privatization in place. He's the one who did it. He's the one who pulled the trigger on it. And he's responsible for this vast privatization of NSA, which, I have to say, began before 9/11.
Can you Talk about Booz Allen Hamilton in terms of its other clients. Here it has this remarkable access to information. You know, as Edward Snowden said in his video statement, which we ran yesterday on Democracy Now, he could wiretap almost anyone at his level, and that a lot of people could. The information that people like Snowden get, can Booz Allen then share this information with other corporate clients it has?
Well, I don't know that for sure, because it's very difficult to penetrate these companies. But I don't think so. I think what they do is they operate just like the intelligence community does, like the, you know, the NSA shares the information with other agencies. Of course, the NSA collects, is the main collector for the government in terms of signals intelligence, what comes over the internet and telephone and cell phones and all that. And they pass that on to other agencies that request it. It goes to the President of the United States. It goes to all the high levels of the State Department and other agencies that need to know what's going on, both around the world and inside the United States. And so I doubt that they would pass it to other corporations, but they certainly have their hands in it. And I think if Booz Allen is doing this and has access to such high-level documents, then you know that these other companies do, too. SAIC, Northrop Grumman, all the companies you named at the top of the show, they have the same kinds of access, and they do very much the same kinds of work that Booz Allen does. And I think it's, like I said before, it's just about time we recognized that this is really, you know, Intelligence, Inc. This is a, you know, 70% of it's a for-profit operation. It's a joint venture between government agencies and the private sector. And the private sector makes money off of it. They make big profits from this.
Tim, wondering if you can talk about some more about these companies, specifically Naris and Palantir.
Well, Naris is the company that basically makes a technology that allows agencies, as well as corporations and telecom companies, to intercept traffic coming in, telecom traffic coming in, you know, from the outside, from other countries, on fiber optic cables. And they have this incredible capacity to process information. And you know, a few years in, right after when, you know, when this story started blowing up and after the New York Times blew the story on surveillance, warrantless surveillance, you know, there was this whistleblower at AT&T, this technician, who found that, you know, Naris equipment had been attached to AT&T's switching center in San Francisco, and they were using this equipment to divert the entire traffic, everything that was coming in. They diverted that to a secret room, and that went right into the NSA's servers.
That was my
And
Klein.
That's what Naris technology does. And so, you know,
and
that's
Naris
the key.
Is owned by Boeing?
Boeing. It was bought by Boeing. It was actually the company originated actually in Israel. You know, Israel has a very powerful equivalent to the National Security Agency, and it came out of Israel. And then they brought their technology here, and they were very involved in the wiretapping right after 9/11. And then Boeing bought them. And of course, Boeing itself is a major intelligence contractor through that company, and you know, they own a company that used to transport a lot of these prisoners around that the CIA captured overseas.
And Palantir.
You asked about Palantir. It's a San Francisco Silicon Valley company that basically does, you know, data mining and mapping out relationships. I mean, all this, as I said in the Salon article yesterday, all this information, all this data that comes into the NSA has to be analyzed, and that's what these companies they do that they hire. You know, the NSA stores all this data. We know this story about this big Utah data center that's just about to open, and they download it all there, and then they can go back to it. They can go back to it a day later, or they can go back to it months later or years later. And that's one of the things that Mr. Snowden talked about in his interviews, was how they go back and analyze this data.
I wanted to ask you about The Guardian in its reports calling the NSA contractor Edward Snowden, who fed them information, whistleblower. But the Associated Press says it would instead use terms like source or leaker. In a memo sent to reporters, it said, quote, a whistleblower is a person who exposes wrongdoing. It's not a person who simply asserts that what he's uncovered is illegal or immoral. Whether the actions exposed by Snowden and Bradley Manning constitute wrongdoing is hotly contested. Sometimes whether a person is a whistleblower can be established only sometime after the revelations, depending on what wrongdoing is confirmed or how public opinion eventually develops, unquote. What do you make of what the AP is saying? I mean, of course, they change their definitions over time. We just saw them drop the word illegal when it comes to describing people.
Well, I think it's kind of semantics. I mean, you know, he's blown the whistle on some actions that the NSA is doing, some programs the NSA is doing that may be unconstitutional. And I think, you know, that's why Daniel Ellsberg has had so much praise for him. I mean, he's showing the underside of the war on terror, the underside of the surveillance state. And I think in that sense, he's a real whistleblower. You know, perhaps the difference between him and, say, the NSA 4, Tom Drake and Bill Binney and the others is that, you know, the NSA 4 did not leak information. I mean, they reported it through the chain of command, or they tried to. And what's unfortunate was, you know, they tried to do this, and then they were caught up in an investigation of who leaked to the New York Times about the NSA surveillance program, and they were persecuted and investigated. And Tom Drake was actually indicted under the Espionage Act and charged with being a spy. Those charges were ridiculous, and the case completely collapsed. But nevertheless, that's what happened to them. So Snowden maybe looked at that and decided, you know, he's just, you know, why go through channels? I mean, I think if we had a system where people could actually expose wrongdoing and without fear of being persecuted, that he may not have broken the law. And I think we need to look very carefully at that, because we need to protect people like this who want to expose wrongdoing.
Tim Short, is it harder for Snowden as a private contractor to try to blow the whistle than it would have been had he been working directly for the government?
Well, perhaps so. I'm not sure what the difference in how they might prosecute somebody like this, but clearly from what's being said, you know, today and what was said yesterday, they're going after him. In fact, I've heard they may charge him under the Espionage Act. So that's what they would do to a government official as well, or an intelligence officer who leaked the same kind of thing. So I don't really think it's that much different. And like I said at the top of the show, you know, what really amazed me was the fact that, you know, Booz Allen Hamilton as a corporation is involved at this level of intelligence. It's not that this guy was just a low-level employee. It's that this company is involved, and you have the private sector at that level of NSA.
What do you think should be done differently? I mean, there's two different issues here. One is the level of privatization of the military and intelligence. And the other is what Edward Snowden has actually revealed about what the U.S. government is doing with our information.
Well, what should we do about specifically what?
In terms of these private intelligence contractors and the access they have.
Well, you know, there's been a process underway where the agencies are supposed to be doing, you know, inventories of who the contractors and what they do. And I think, you know, there was a report I saw recently from the Inspector General of the Pentagon that looked at the Special Operations Command, which is, you know, Jeremy Scahill's been writing about it. It's the most secretive part of the U.S. military, does these raids all over the world. And they looked at their contracts, and they found that a lot of JSOC and special operations contractors were doing inherently governmental work. In other words, they were doing things that, by law, should only be done by the government. And at that level, there was very loose oversight. And I think that we need to look as a country, and the government certainly needs to do this, and Congress certainly needs to do this. You know, okay, it's okay. You know, it's fine to buy technology from corporations if they need it, but using corporations to fill your ranks, you know, to provide personnel. I mean, you go to these agencies, and it's, you know, it's not exactly like this, but it's very much like a NASCAR race where they have logos, corporate logos are all over themselves. I mean, that's what it's like inside the NSA. You got CSC over here, you got Northrop Grumman over here, Lockheed Martin, and so on. Do we need to have the private sector doing all this analysis? I think that's a very critical question to be asked. Do we want to have private corporations at the highest levels? And again, you know, if that's something, that's something that Congress, I believe, should really look at. And in the time that I've been covering this, as far as I recall, there's only been one single hearing in Congress on this issue of intelligence contractors. And it was 3 years ago, and it was a pathetic hearing. They actually called me in for some advice, and they actually called Tom Drake in for advice, too. I didn't know it at the time. And they, of course, they didn't use any of our suggestions.
The man they charged with espionage?
The U.S. government had been charged with espionage,
who, of course, ultimately, those charges were dropped and has been called by many a whistleblower.
Right. He's a true whistleblower. But the point, you know, I said, you know, you ought to call in the chief executives of Booz Allen, Hamilton, all these companies, so the American people can meet the secret leaders of the intelligence community. We know who Clapper is. We knew, you know, we knew when Hayden was director, we knew who he was, but we don't know these people
McConnell.
That are running these corporations. McConnell, Michael McConnell, used to be the director of national intelligence. Before that, he was NSA director. And, you know, in between, he was at Booz Allen Hamilton running their military intelligence programs. Now he's back at Booz Allen Hamilton. So there's this continuous, you know, flow of people in and out of the private sector back into government. It's not even a revolving door. It's just a spinning door. But basically what we have is an intelligence ruling class, public and private, that hold the secrets. And I think, you know, when Bill Binney talks about the Stasi, the East German police that listen to everybody, you know, look, we have hundreds of thousands of contractors with security clearances. We have hundreds of thousands of federal workers in, you know, Homeland Security and intelligence. We have a massive number of people that are monitoring other Americans. I think it's a very dangerous situation.
Tim Sherrock, I want to thank you for being with us. Investigative reporter covers national security. His most recent piece at Salon.com is Meet the Contractors, Analyzing Your Private Data. Private companies are getting rich probing your personal information for the government. Call it digital Blackwater. He's author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll look at the Walmart shareholders meeting and what happened outside and in. Stay with us.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté.
Well, the annual shareholders meeting of the retail giant Walmart was held last week in the company's home state of Arkansas. Thousands of Walmart workers were flown in for a week-long celebration of the world's largest retailer. In some ways, it resembled a major Hollywood event. The singers Jennifer Hudson, Elton John, Kelly Clarkson, and John Legend all made appearances. The actor Hugh Jackman served as master of ceremonies for Friday's meeting inside a sports arena named after Walmart co-founder Bud Walton. To the cheers of thousands of spectators, the actor Tom Cruise took the stage to praise Walmart's global reach.
Very pleased to be here. I truly admire your company. You know, and the more I learn about everything that you do, I'm inspired by what you all create every day. You know, because your company, and I'm sure you all know this, but it is a role model for how business can address some of the biggest issues facing our world, you know, in ways big and small. And all around the globe, Walmart is taking the lead and making a difference. And that's something I really admire. You know, what this company does is it's using its size and scale to improve women's lives across the world.
But amidst the celebration of Walmart, there also came protests. The group Our Walmart brought its demand for the company to commit to giving workers full-time employment and a minimum salary of $25,000 a year. Around 100 striking workers staged a series of actions after arriving in a caravan from across the country. They've walked off the job in Florida, Massachusetts, California, to protest what they allege to be worker retaliation against those seeking to change company practices on wages, worker safety and unions. Although small in size, it's Walmart's longest strike to date. Inside the shareholders' meeting, the workers and activists took advantage of a brief window to present non-binding resolutions before thousands of their colleagues, as well as the company's top executives. The measures were all defeated because the founding Walton family still owns more than half the company's stock. Janet Sparks, a Louisiana Walmart employee, drew applause when she compared the wages of struggling U.S. workers to CEO Mike Duke's $20.7 million paycheck.
We all know that times are tough for many of our customers. But I want you to know that times are tough for many Walmart associates, too. We are stretching our paychecks to pay our bills and support our families. So when I think about the fact that our CEO, Mike Duke, made over $20 million last year, more than 1,000 times the average Walmart associate, with all due respect, I have to say, I don't think that's right.
Also speaking out there was Kalpana Akhtar, a workers' rights activist from Bangladesh. She urged Walmart to stop rejecting new safety standards after the Dhaka building collapse that killed over 1,100 workers in April. Kalpana Akhtar made a direct appeal to Walmart chair Rob Walton.
Mr. Rob Walton, I'm sure you know that these fixing buildings would cause just a tiny friction of your family world. So I implore to you, please help us. You have the power to do this very easily. Don't you agree that the factories where Walmart products are made should be safe for the workers? For years, every time there is an accident, Walmart officials have made promise to improve the terrible conditions in my country's garment factories. But the tragedies continue. With all due respect, the time for empty promises is over.
Walmart is one of only a few major retailers that have refused to sign on to the new safety standards after the Dhaka tragedy. For more, we're joined now by Kalpana Akhtar herself, just back from attending the Walmart meeting, executive director of the Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity. She started work in garment factories when she was 12. She's currently in the United States to call on retailers like Walmart, The Gap, and Disney to take the lead on improving working conditions in Bangladesh. And we're joined by Scott Nova, executive director of the Worker Rights Consortium, which investigates working conditions in the factories around the world. We contacted Walmart to join us, but they said they were unavailable. The Gap did not respond to our request for an interview. Kalpana Akhtar, what about the response to what you had to say in the Walmart shareholders meeting?
The response was, I would say, it was zero, which was expected, because this Walton will not get back to you when it is come the time to pay the workers or improve the working conditions. So they didn't respond at all. But our point was the people need to be heard. These Waltons and the Walmart other shareholders, they should know from us, from the first-hand information, that what's really going on there. They shouldn't just close their eyes and say, or just wash their hand and say that, oh, we didn't know that, or it wasn't our fault. It was our sorcerer who was killing these workers in back home.
Well, Walmart said no one from the company was able to join us today, but they sent us a statement that said, quote, some media reports have given the impression there was production for Walmart happening in Rana Plaza at the time of the tragic building collapse. That's wrong. Our investigation after the collapse revealed no evidence of authorized or unauthorized production at the time of the tragedy. Meanwhile, in May, Walmart announced it would terminate its contract with Canadian jeans maker Fame Jeans after documents surfaced the company ordered pants from inside Rana Plaza. So are these satisfactory steps to you?
It is not. I mean, first, they are sourcing from the outsourcer. And when it is come to say that, yes, our products were there, now they are just saying that, oh, we are cutting the contact with our sourcing companies. I mean, definitely, this is not a satisfactory answer for us. Well, that Walmart should take responsibility. They were producing their clothes in Rana Plaza, but not in the time when the factory collapsed. But they had connection. They could even improve this factory condition. They could prevent this death, and Rana collapse would be even prevented.
There was the fire, mm-hmm. and then there was the building collapse, two different buildings, two different workplaces. Yes. Did Walmart refer to any officially from the stage at the shareholders meeting?
I was surprised that they haven't said any word about this fire and about this building collapse.
How many people died in the fire?
In the fire, in Tazreen Fashion Fire, it has killed 112 workers and left hundreds injured. And in Rana Plaza, it killed 1,127 and left more than 600 or 700 injured for a lifetime. And in that shareholder meeting, they haven't even given any condolence for those families. They haven't felt sad. No word for those.
Scott Nova, the wider picture here. Can you talk about how companies like Walmart and others use subcontractors to employ people in places like DACA?
Sure. Well, it's crucial to understand Walmart and the other big Western retailers didn't stumble into a worker safety crisis in Bangladesh. They helped to cause that crisis by placing tremendous pressure on their contract suppliers in Bangladesh to produce for ever lower prices, giving them overwhelming incentive to reduce production costs by ignoring safety standards. This is the fundamental reason why workers are dying in Bangladesh in factories producing for companies like Walmart.
What are the safety standards that are being proposed that the Gap and Walmart have not signed on to, but other corporations like H&M have?
Well, for the first time in the contemporary history of the global apparel industry, major brands and retailers have signed a binding, enforceable agreement under which they must pay to carry out building renovations, repairs, and retrofitting necessary to turn these death trap factories into safe structures. H&M, the biggest producer in Bangladesh, has signed. Carrefour, the second largest global retailer after Walmart, has signed. Inditex, the biggest fashion retailer, has signed. But Walmart and Gap refuse to make these binding commitments to clean up their factories in Bangladesh and make them safe.
What are the commitments and who wrote this contract?
The agreement was developed by non-governmental organizations and both global and Bangladeshi labor unions. Under the agreement, the brands and retailers must open their factories up to independent inspections by competent safety experts with full public reports of all inspections, and then they must compel the factories to carry out any and all building repairs and renovations necessary to address safety hazards and make the building safe, installing fire exits, which most of these buildings don't have, to offer a critical example. They must then leave, cease doing business with any factory that refuses to undertake these repairs and renovations, except the critical point, the brands and retailers have to pay for the repairs and renovations. They can't place the burden purely on the factory. And if the factories will take the money and undertake the renovations and operate safely, then the brands and retailers have to stay and continue to produce at those factories and support the factory and support the workers.
And what would it mean if Walmart signed on?
Walmart is the second biggest producer in Bangladesh after H&M. Walmart's refusal to participate means that there are hundreds of factories and tens of thousands of workers that are outside the protective scope of this accord, which means that the safety hazards in those factories won't be addressed, the safety of those workers won't be protected.
These are some of the voices of workers shortly after the Rana Plaza disaster who said the factory owners forced them to go to work even after they found massive cracks in the building's walls.
We didn't want to go up in the factory this morning, but the management forced us to go up and said there was no problem with the building. Just after that, I sat on my table to work, and the building just collapsed. I couldn't even leave. I was trapped at my table.
I started my work at 8 this morning. At about 9:30, I suddenly heard a strange sound, and I saw the building was collapsing. I then ran through a stairwell and jumped down. I lost consciousness, but I was rescued by others.
Inside at about 9:10 a.m., the building collapsed, and we were trapped inside since then and up to now. It is 10:18 p.m., 11 hours we were trapped. We did not want to enter the building, but the owners pushed us to get in and work.
Some of the voices of those workers who escaped the Rana Plaza collapse. I wanted to go to what Walmart and the Gap, these two, and I'm sorry that they wouldn't join us, but are saying about not signing on to this contract that other multinational multinational corporations are signing on to.
Well, one of Walmart's most astonishing excuses, their claim is that the inspections they themselves do with no transparency or accountability will be a faster mechanism for protecting worker safety in Bangladesh. This from a company that has been producing in Bangladesh for nearly a quarter of a century, and during that time has done nothing to protect the safety of workers. Gap's main argument is some abstruse claim about supposed legal liability that they face. It's a trumped-up claim. Gap's real concern is that they don't want to pay the costs of repairing these buildings and making them safe. But even if there is legal liability, the question for Gap is, are they saying that workers in Bangladesh should continue to die so Gap can be protected from litigation? That appears to be their position.
And since we just played these voices from the Rana Plaza, Kalpana, again, the documents that surfaced, what, 3 weeks after, because Walmart was called, they said, we are not making clothing in this factory now.
Yeah, I mean, we found that documents in the rubble, and my colleagues and me, we went there, and we found that. And it is clearly says that Fame Jeans was—Fame Jeans, one of the outsourcing of Walmart, was sourcing clothes from EtherTex, a factory was located in Rana Plaza. And there were, when I saw the email in relevant to Fame Jeans and Walmart, I called the person, there was a merchandiser, I called personally to that person to be confirmed that Walmart was there. And he confirmed, yes, the Walmart was sourcing from our company last year.
We're going to continue this conversation and talk also about Walmart workers in the United States. Kalpana Akhtar, Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity, is her organization, Scott Nova Worker Rights Consortium. And when I come back, Josh Idelson will also be joining us, talking about Walmart workers in the United States. Stay with us.
Listen up. We've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us. Fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon's solidarity. Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling.
Anne Feeney singing War on the Workers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté. To talk more about Walmart, we're joined by Josh Idelson, a journalist that's covering labor issues for The Nation's, reported from the Walmart shareholders meeting last week, also contributing writer for Salon.com. And in these times, we are still with Kalpana Akhtar, executive director of the Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity, and Scott Nova, executive director of the Worker Rights Consortium. Josh Idelson, can you make a link between what Scott and Kalpana are talking about with worker conditions abroad and what's happening here, this growing movement around Walmart?
So in each case, we see a challenge to Walmart's business model, a business model that we see the most extreme consequences of in places like Bangladesh. When you talk to some of the workers in the United States, though, what they will tell you is the difference is just a question of what Walmart can get away with. So we see this push down on costs and this active effort to suppress worker organizing that has consequences that are dramatic and then has daily consequences in terms of the poverty of Walmart workers in the United States. In each case, though, we now see a challenge. And so we see a strike wave that's moved through Walmart's supply chain. We see Walmart retail workers, workers in Walmart contracted warehouses, and Walmart workers abroad making common cause and taking on the company. And we saw that in Arkansas when the strikers came to crash Walmart's party in Arkansas. One of the most dramatic actions I witnessed there was workers, along with Kalpana Akhter, along with international Walmart workers, lining up across from Walmart's home office headquarters to sing a dirge about the deaths in Bangladesh, to read Bible verses. And as they did this, some of those thousands of Walmart employees that were flown in by Walmart started watching, listening, taking pictures. At that point, Walmart management started leading those workers in the Walmart cheer. Give me a W, give me an A, what does that spell, Walmart? They were having workers do this cheer, as about 50 feet away, you had workers chanting, which side are you on, Walmart? Are you on the side of safety or are you on the side of murder?
Josh, what are some of the key complaints that our Walmart has against Walmart? And what do you say to the company or supporters of the company? I imagine saying, well, look, it's only 100 workers. It's a small strike.
So this absolutely is a small strike. The workers' main demands have been around wages, which one estimate pegged at $8.81 an hour currently, around health care, around staffing, which they say creates problems both for customers and for workers, and around retaliation against workers who organize. Walmart is right to say that this is so far a very small minority of workers who are active. What Walmart is not saying is that Walmart is doing everything in its power to prevent this from getting bigger. We see what in labor organizing we call carrots and sticks. So on the one hand, Walmart has begun to make moves at least to appear to address some of these grievances. On the other hand, you have these mandatory captive audience meetings where the company lectures workers in mandatory meetings about not getting involved. And you have over 150 allegations of illegal retaliation and intimidation against workers to prevent them from stepping up. And so when Walmart says it's not concerned, it's fair to say that they're bluffing.
And explain what our Walmart is.
So our Walmart is an organization significantly backed by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. It's part of the array of alt-labor groups that are organizing workers outside of collective bargaining, without demanding collective bargaining, but using mobilization, political, community, legal, media pressure, and industrial activism like these strikes, which we have never seen at Walmart in the United States up until last year, in order to try to transform the company's business model.
Scott Nova, why are you here in New York?
We are here this week to meet with the controller of the city of New York, to participate in an event that he organized for investors, to talk about the enormous risks for investors that Walmart's reckless policies in Bangladesh are creating.
This is John Liu, who is also running
for mayor.
Exactly.
John Liu. The failure of Walmart and Gap and other retailers to sign on to this critical fire safety agreement is not only, of course, extremely bad for workers, it's ultimately bad for the shareholders of these companies, because the risk to the reputation of these companies, if there is another fire, if there is another building collapse, is enormous. But the executives are acting recklessly, refusing to acknowledge that risk and refusing to take the steps necessary to protect worker safety in their facilities in that country.
Kalpana Akhter, as you travel the country, do you feel that there's a different awareness about what's going on in places like Bangladesh? And are you concerned that if you raise these concerns, that these corporations will just move to the next country?
In terms of the awareness, yeah, I mean, this is different level of awareness. If we consider, like, for the last 5 years, I would say that the consumers, I mean, they're the main part of this supply chain. So they are more aware than before. And of course, many things come give awareness through the medias. So this is really a different level I can see in these days. So.
And the issue of whether Bangladesh.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really a big point.
And we have 10 seconds.
Yeah, whether these companies will be moved. I would say no. Because the Bangladesh is the world's cheapest country in these days, and there is no alternative market for these retailers to move. So they should be keep doing their business, but in the same time, they should sign this accord and make a safe working place for our workers.
I want to thank you all for being with us. We're going to do part two right after the show and post it at democracynow.org. Kalpana Akhter, Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity, Scott Nova, Worker Rights Consortium, and Josh Idelson writes for The Nation and In These Times and Salon.com. This is Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Martinez DeRosta, Nemo Allen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Naguera, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, Christian Goff, Vesta Godarz, and our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Craig Meadows, Rockham Penny, and Carlo DeJesus. Our website is democracynow.org. You can see the transcripts, and you can see past shows there. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Thanks so much for joining us. Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much.